It was my honor to meet her for the first time tonight. Her name is Erin, and Stephanie and Dylan went to the 805 group and talked to Erin, got to know her, and they said they love to hear her story, and they, at our group conscious, they suggested it. So I'm looking very forward to hearing your story, as is everybody else. So why don't you come on up here? Give me a hug.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. I love the hugs here. And I have a timer and a microphone. Yes. My name is Erin. I'm an addict alcoholic. It's always a little nerve-wracking going to new meetings, and then I sit down and come to find that I'm recorded also tonight, so there's no pressure, none. And for a minute, I'm thinking, oh, God, I got to come up with something really awesome right now. And as I'm sitting here thinking and listening to how it works and all that, my primary purpose is to carry the message, and that's it. So, you know, a lot of the things that I've learned, a lot of things that I'll say are things that I've stolen from other people. I got sober around a lot of old-timers, so the one-liners are close to my heart. They've always worked for me. and... You know, it's funny, I was talking to my friend before I got here on the phone, and I was like, you know, I'm a little nervous, and I said, the longer I'm sober, the harder it is for me to go back to what it was like. And my sobriety date is December 8th, 2010. I do have a sponsor and a home group, which is a KISS group. We meet Saturday mornings in Bellmede or Bellevue, it's one of those. You know, my life has transformed so much. You know, I just came up on 8 years in December, and so it, so much has happened since December 8, 2010. And so it's not often that I go back 8 years and just, you know, ponder like that shitty, terrible, dark, depressive nightmare that I was living. It's only on occasions like this that I have to do that. So, but it's important, and it's vital to my recovery that I remember where I come from. And so I, you know, Stephanie asked me, and I didn't think twice, because I've been kind of in my head the last few months. A lot's been going on, and when she asked me, I've been around long enough to know that, you know, not only do you just say yes if you can, but I was like, you know, I know that I need this, and it's probably going to help me more than anything. And so I said, absolutely. And then she mentioned that there's food. And so, you know, I was totally on board with that. And there's candy, too. I look forward to that coming around. So I am going to go back down memory lane of being an alcoholic, an active alcoholic, and, you know, drugs were part of my story. I won't go into that so much. I was born and raised in Chicago. I had a good childhood. I was athletic, extremely athletic, and very talented. And, you know, I got into traveling basketball and AAU, and was, you know, if I was the girl that the other team feared when I walked out on the court, I was, you know, I don't brag a lot about myself, but I would kick some ass in basketball. And so I did that. And then, you know, when I was younger, that was my passion, was just basketball, like eat, sleep, and, you know, play basketball. And school, not so much. Did not like school. You know, so I struggled through that. I recently got diagnosed with ADHD, which I was weirdly surprised at, but then when I started to go through the process of understanding what it is, I look back at my childhood, and it makes sense why school was not for me. So, you know, I did the sports things when I was younger, and I didn't get into too much trouble. Okay, you know what? That's a lie. I was a bad kid. You know, I grew up on the north side of Chicago. My dad was a Chicago cop, and my mom worked for a, you know, hospital, and they were, you know, hardworking Americans, and, you know, they did everything they could just to raise a good family and to give us everything we wanted. And so for all these, you know, basketball events, I had, you know, the best shoe, you know, $120 gym shoes and all, you know, I was, they were good to me. My parents were amazing, and they showed me, you know, love and what a family can be. But, you know, towards the end of like eighth grade, you know, start drinking, and you know, I was by no means like raised like in the ghetto part of Chicago, but it certainly wasn't the suburbs. There were, you know, gangs prevalent, and you know, there were, it was just like city kid stuff. I mean, we would go in and God, I feel bad saying this, but you know, we would throw, you know, cans of pop off the freeway and go car kicking, which is, if you don't know what it is, you just get on your bicycle and ride down the street and kick in every door of every car that you pass. So, yeah, that's that was, you know, it's so the rebellion started pretty early on. I've actually never shared that in a meeting. I don't know if I will again. I feel like a really shitty person right now. If that was one of your cars, yeah. I'm sorry. you know, I got in seventh grade, I started smoking, and, you know, I did do some, you know, I was in the principal's office more than I was in class. You know, they knew me, and, you know, the grades weren't well, and so there were struggles when I was younger, and, for whatever reason, I just had that rebellion in me. After eighth grade, my dad retired from the police department, and we moved to the suburbs, like Pleasantville. All the houses look the same, and everyone's lawn is so nicely mowed, and it's like, okay, this is awesome. And I didn't adjust to that well, because I had the same group of friends growing up for, like 6 years. There was just seven of us, you know, solid, just, you know, best friends for years. And so when I moved, I lost all of that, went from, you know, drinking in the woods and being somewhat of a bad kid to this, you know, suburban area where everyone's nice and their kids, you know, everyone's all good and stuff. And I was like, man, I don't know what to do. I was like, you know, I think I need to go shopping at Abercrombie and Fitch. Isn't that what, that's what they wear, right? Like Abercrombie and Fitch. And so literally I'm trying to change my wardrobe just to like blend in with these, you know, with this new school. So I start high school, and certainly it was a little out of place. And I guess my way of falling into place was to get everyone else on board with my rebellion trends, and I brought the city to the suburbs and introduced, you know, everyone to like smoking tons of weed, and before you know it, we're all doing cocaine, and we're, you know, 15 years old, and so we all slowly, I think, you know, everyone fed off each other, and you're in that stage of life where it's like cool and you get to do bad things and like, you know, fuck the system and fuck my parents. And sorry, I don't know if I could swear on this recording, but too bad. So for a while there was just like this transition, and I kind of lost my way, and then I found my way. And but I think I was still lost. There was that lost feeling the whole time. And when I look back, I think I had that too. I don't know what it was, but now we know. You know, it was, you know, to say alcoholism at eight years old, I mean, I didn't have a drinking problem, but the way that I thought, I have very self-centered thinking. I always have. So the partying was partying until it was not. We hear that a lot. It was really fun. I had a lot of good times. You know, it just, you know, freshman year, and I might go back and forth because I'll start to remember things that I don't like to remember, but, you know, freshman year, it was this first year that I moved to this to the suburbs, and it's kind of a blur, but I remember apparently I shared with my counselor that, like, I was troubled or I felt depressed and this and that, and so they gave me, like, this depression test, and I thought nothing of it, and I came back severely depressed, and next thing I know, they're sending me to rehab. Like, I've only been in this, you know, town for 3 months, and I'm like, okay. So So I did that, you know, so as far as mental health or being, you know, in any kind of treatment, that started early on. And I'm trying to remember. I ended up getting sober, and I think it was, I'm trying to remember, because I think the drinking was part of it, and that came, you know, to light. And so I was also in, like, you know, alcohol and drug classes. And so my first introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 16 years old when I first got sober, and I stayed sober for 9 months. And I had a sponsor, and it was almost like it was fun back then. You know, there was no consequences. I didn't have a single consequence. I just thought you guys were, you know, not you guys, but, you know, my family and everyone around me was like, you guys are party poopers. Like, I'm having a good time. Why are you ruining this? So I got sober at 16, was going to meetings. You know, I mean, back then you could smoke in meetings and, you know, cleaning up ashtrays and all that. And I was just was not ready. You know, I did not have enough fun. And so very quickly things escalated, and the, you know, kind of random, spontaneous, like, ooh, let's do a little coke or this and that, you know, that turned into a thing. That turned into a Friday night thing and Saturday night thing, you know, and some other mind-altering substances, whatever was around. You know, I just found myself, like, in this world of escape where I didn't have to deal with the feelings that I couldn't understand. And so that continued. And, you know, it wasn't bad until it was bad. And then I turned 21, and that was awesome. And from then on, for the next 3 years, was progressive alcoholism. And it's escalated very quickly. I know it says in the book that it escalates in women quicker than men, which I'm sure that that's true. I know, I mean, it fucking escalated real quick for me. And before I knew it, it was like, you know, it was about, you know, it, in the beginning, it was about going out in the bars and drinking and having fun because I'm 21. Then it turned into, you know, being a womanizer and, like, picking up chicks at the bar and whatever, and, like, you know, being, you know, just like this, you know, single 21-year-old, and I just want, you know, I was in the prime and whatever. And so then I was getting into the partying even harder, and I'm meeting all these different people at these bars, and, like, you know, you think you're all, like, friends, like, but the only thing you have in common is, like, that, you know, I'm supplying tequila for you, so you're gonna, you know, bring me to this party because I'm the life of the party. So, and, you know, and it turned into, it things, my standards lowered, and the things that I was doing while under the influence were things that, if I, you know, I don't even like to talk about or think about, because they were very, what is the word? I guess, I don't want to say disgusting, but things I am not proud of. And, you know, there was a lot of sexual activity going on when you're under the influence. I don't know if anyone knows anything about that, but, you know, you give me, you know, an 8-ball of cocaine and 24-pack, and, you know, who knows what's going to happen. And that's what it was, but the thing was, is I kind of started to cross that line, because I think there was a point in my life where I was like, you know, I had a conscience about, like, okay, this might not be a good idea, and I got to that point where this might be a bad idea, but I'm not going to let it stop me. And so that craving for more, that phenomenon of craving started to build up, and it was no longer about the scene, it was no longer about partying, it was not about having fun because I was 21. And at some point, you know, I don't know where I crossed that line, but I did cross that line. And I became a slave to alcohol. And, you know, the end of my drinking and the end of my, you know, career, it was mostly booze. I mean, there was a lot of other things that would come into play, but alcohol became my best friend. And, you know, And this is a hard part where I try to think back to like how bad it really was. And I started to black out in a very kind of dangerous ways, where I would call my mom at 2 a.m. walking down the freeway barefoot in the pouring rain, and I don't know where I'm at. And that was, you know, that was my life, and that became my family's life. That became my mom staying up, not being able to sleep at night because she doesn't know what phone call she's going to get. She doesn't know where I'm going to be and if I'm even going to be alive. And at that point, I was at that point where I was fully in my alcoholism, that I was completely unaware of what I was doing to her. I was completely unaware of what I was doing to anyone around me. I was completely unaware of the effect that I had on my life and the effect that drinking had on my life, physically, mentally, emotionally, my well-being, relationships, everything. You know, for me, there were a lot of yets. I didn't lose things. And so it, you know, it was still a free ride for me. You know, I didn't lose things. I didn't lose jobs. I never got fired. I always quit before he could fire me. You know, I didn't have a house because I didn't have a job, so I couldn't have lost a house because I, you know. And my parents maintained, you know, and they played the enabler. And they didn't know what to do, and they're a little bit older, so I think that they were kind of naive, where they didn't really know what to do with this. But when I came home and they knew I was, you know, upset, or they could tell that I was drinking or whatever, and I'm just like, you know, I need $20. You know, she would get a little pissy, but she didn't know what else to do for me because our relationship was already growing apart. She couldn't talk to me. I was unpleasant. They stopped inviting me to family dinners, and so I think she just gave me the money just to shut me up. And so there was a turning point where my family started to not like me being around. And I didn't find out about this actually until like I was 2 years sober. And I remember when my mom told me that, and it was really kind of heartbreaking to hear. So I lost my train of thought there. So the blackout started to scare the shit out of my family, and I was in an oblivion. I was in a complete oblivion. Drinking when I woke up, 10 a.m., drinking MGDs. My mom says, I remember this is one of the few things I remember about like the end, was that I woke up hungover in mom's home, and I go in the fridge and it's 10 a.m. and I grab an MGD out of the bottle. And she says, you know, don't you think it's a little early to be drinking? And I just remember I got so offended, like, how dare, no, like, don't question me. Like, there's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. You are the problem. Stop judging me, you know? And so that was kind of another turning point when I look back, that the drinking had a hold on me. The drinking had its way with me, and at that point I had no control over the craving. And so I was waking up and drinking and making sure that there was at least one or two people that was willing to go out every night with me, because that's, you know, I wanted to go to the bar and I don't want to be the only one there looking like a complete alcoholic. So if I get everyone else to want to go out, you know, they don't know my intent is to get totally fucked up and blacked out. But that's what it was. And so it became this kind of, what's the word I'm thinking of? You know, it was a whole new lifestyle. It was a whole new life that just revolved around getting drunk, going to bars, and forgetting about my life, forgetting about the fact that I threw away a basketball scholarship. I probably could have gone to the WNBA. It's a true story. And, you know, rewind a little, but in high school, freshman year, I got onto the basketball team, and I was still, you know, the female Michael Jordan. I was amazing. I was good. And so the first year went well. And by sophomore year, my grades started dropping. And there was the first time I had a consequence where I was put on academic probation. And eventually I was like, well, you know, screw that. I'm not, they want me to come practice, but I can't play in the games. And so I was like, you know, I quit. And so I did that and just, you know, this passion that I've had my whole life, I just kind of gave up on real quickly. You know, I didn't care anymore. And then next year I got, I went to tryouts. And at this point, the varsity coach knew me, you know, they knew how good I was. I came to tryouts, and the first day we got maybe an hour into, you know, tryouts, and they're, you know, we're all running sprints and stuff. And at this point, I've been smoking, and you know, there's, you know, smoking weed or whatever. And so my body is out of shape. And after an hour, I'm out of breath, and I go and I have to stop. And I go, I tell my coach, I'm like, I just can't do this. I can't keep up. My lungs are giving out, and I'm a little tired. And she said, all right, well, she said, go home and come back tomorrow. Now, they don't really do that. I mean, if you can't keep up in tryouts, there's a whole damn point of tryouts. Like, you can't make it. But because I had this free ride because of how good I was, I got this pass, you know. We'll brush it off. Just come back tomorrow. And eventually I did, and I made the team. And I've actually never shared this either. Made the team, and you know, a couple months in, and I had missed a few practices and didn't show up for one game, and I got a phone call. And I remember that phone call, and basically it was, you know, this is the end of the road for you, and we got to let you go. And so that was a really defining moment in my life where I had been working so hard and had this passion and had a passion for life and just felt alive playing basketball. That was my thing, and that fell by the wayside, and I didn't really care at that point, you know. And that's what happens when we get, you know, when we get to that stage of alcoholism, is that, like I said, your standards lower and you stop caring about what your life looks like as long as you can get the next drink. I don't care. And so, you know, I'm blacking out, you know, going back. The bars were just blackouts, and I was ending up in places with people I didn't know. I couldn't tell you what the addresses were, or what city or, you know, well, I knew what state I was in, but I didn't know what city I was in. And I don't even think I need to mention that the relationships that I was in throughout this period were not healthy. Not one single one. They were toxic. I dated people that like to drink like me. And so that was never my strong suit either. And where am I on time? Huh. That went by fast. All right. I'll fast forward a little bit. The blackouts continued. I started to really kind of scare my family. My mom, we drink downstairs, and she said there was a point where I didn't even want to go downstairs. I didn't want to see what was going on. I didn't want to know what I would find. And so one day I'm at this bar, Dirty Nelly's, and I got two beers in my hand. I'm double fisting. I'm having the time of my life. And I run into this guy named Eric. Now, I knew Eric from back when I was 16 years old, like 10 years ago, from Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were good friends, and I see him, and he's like 10 years sober, he's got like a nice shirt, he's got like a cup of water, and he just looks like, you know, he's doing life the right way. And he's like, you know, how are you? And I'm like, I'm great, I'm awesome, how are you doing, you know? And we have this moment, and he obviously sees, he knew. And at the time, I didn't know what was happening, but he said, you know, here, why don't you take my number, you know? Give me a call sometime. And I get his number, and God, I mean, went right back to the bar, forgot all about this encounter completely. And before I knew it, I started making these calls to Eric in blackouts. And this is the first time, when I look back, that God was trying very hard to intervene with my alcoholism. And I was making these phone calls, and I don't remember any of them. But when I got sober, he told me, you know, he said, your calls were scary. He said, you were scaring me. And I was making these calls, I guess, asking for help and just in total, you know, sobbing about my life and just in that deep place where I just can't escape anymore. I can't escape my feelings. I can't escape the shame, the guilt. the embarrassing things I'm doing while I'm at these parties or whatever. And so, so I was familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that when I went into a meeting, you know, the chairs are set up, and I knew the 12 steps were on the walls because I'd done it before, and I never had a bad experience in it. And so I don't exactly remember this phone call too well, but I did make one phone call, and he said, you know, why don't you get in your car and meet me at the Palatine Club? And that was where I got sober 10 years ago. And I was reluctant. He's like, look, I'm getting in my car right now. I'm going to hang up with you. Get in your car and meet me there. And I don't remember driving there. But I remember when I got there, because I pulled up and I parked my car, and I see him getting out of his car, and he's walking, you know, to meet me, and we start walking in, and he looks at me, and all he said was, you know, I'm not staying, right? And I was like, oh, okay. Awesome. And so there I was, you know, that's the, I guess, a 12-step call where I got a tough love introduction, and he walked me in, and he left me there, because it's not his job to get me sober. But when somebody reaches out, you know, whatever that saying is, you know, we're responsible to reach out our hand to, you know, and that's what he did. And he led me to a meeting, and he literally left me there. and so that was that. Of course, it was uncomfortable at first, and I didn't want to go through it, and I didn't know what I was doing. But I knew that I was in so much pain that if I continued like this, at some point I'd end up in a really bad, bad place, or I don't know, I might have killed myself. Who knows what would have happened? And I got sober, kept going to meetings, and I found a sponsor, and asked this woman named Judy, who is still in my life, and she is amazing. And it took me probably like 4 weeks to call her. I've had, you know, like it's, I remember I put her card in this mirror in my bedroom, and I'd like see it every day, you know. And you're just looking at it like, yeah, you know, maybe tomorrow. And eventually I call her, I get a sponsor. And something starts to happen where I realize that there's something in this room that everyone had that I wanted. That you were happy, that you had relationships, that you, you know, dressed nice, and, you know, you were welcoming, and you had hope. And I think the only thing I held on to was that little bit of hope that I had going in meetings. And then when I read the big book, and I don't remember that moment, but I know that when I read the big book, that's what did it for me. I read the first 164 pages, and there were things in there that I was like, somebody read my diary, you know? It was like somebody, you know, and a speaker once said, it's like, you know, it was like I was a mouth looking for a scream, you know? And I just didn't know, I just didn't know how to tell anyone about all this pain I was dealing with until I came to the rooms and I started to hear you and I started to hear you. And I started to realize that there might be other people that go through this stuff, you know? And so, you know, I got involved and started service work early, and I showed up to a meeting 6 months sober in my pajamas. It was about 110 people. And Judy walks up to me and she greets me and she's like all chipper and, good morning, how are you? It's like, I'm fine, how are you? She said, I'm good, I'm good. She said, yeah, so you're speaking. And I was like, what? It was about 4 minutes till the meeting started. Apparently a speaker didn't show up, and she decided this is your time to shine, kids, so get up there. And I panicked, and I call Eric, and I'm like, Eric, I'm like, Judy wants me to speak. I'm at Holy Family, and I'm freaking out. And I was like, what do I do? He's like, you go speak. It's like, okay, thanks for that. I was expecting you to tell me, like, you know, go home. And so I got thrown into Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 Steps in Recovery. It wasn't sugar-coated. Nobody held my hand, you know. And so I can, and I don't know if I do this often, but I can take a lot of credit for my recovery, you know. I didn't have an intervention. I didn't go through rehab. I wasn't mandated to. But I was tired of drinking, and I had to do something. So I got very, not very involved so much in the fellowship, but I dove into the steps. I dove into my recovery. I dove into finding a God. I think it was very clear for me that I had a problem. My life was unmanageable. You know, I don't think I struggled with the first step at all. That was very clear. That's why, you know, was where I was in a fucking AA meeting. You know, finding God, that was a... I don't think it was so much of a challenge, because when you're as desperate as we are and nothing's working, and you tell me this might work, I'm going to do it. And so that's what I did. Found a God, and I held on to that God. I held on to that fucking God for my dear life. And things started to happen, and I got employed, and I got a part-time job. It was my first, you know, started working for FedEx, and I got a part-time job, and before I know it, I got promoted within 2 months, and then I was working full-time, and then another 3 months, I got promoted again, and then I ended up getting promoted again, and that's not to boast, you know, like, oh, I was such an amazing, you know, person, but that was due to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the grace of God allowing me to show up to life, to just show up, suit up and show up. And when I started to participate and look what I could bring to life as opposed to take, things started to work in my favor. I ended up getting my first apartment and then another apartment. And I realized that I can't leave this program. This is where life happens for me. When I try to do it by myself out there, things don't go so well. And I end up waking up not remembering what my life looked like the previous night. I mean, who lives like that where we just wake up, have no clue, have no idea what happened last night, but we're just like, you know, I'm going to go out again and maybe it'll happen. And if it does, that's okay. So I, you know, attended four, sometimes five meetings a week, and chaired meetings and sponsored girls, and spoke anytime that I was asked to speak. And so I can say that I am here today because when I first came in, I built myself a solid foundation. I think that's so crucial. I didn't do 90-90, but I got plugged in and I said yes, and if you told me to do it, I'd do it. And I had a great sponsor, and, you know, I learned very early on that if there's something that you feel like you're not doing, do that. Do exactly what you don't want to do. And that kind of taught me to go against my own will, and that taught me the idea of surrender and trusting and having faith in a power bigger than myself, because obviously my way wasn't working so well. So I guess I'll fast forward again, you know. So, you know, that was what happened. I came in, I surrendered, and God showed up for me. And I started to show up for him. And I got connected and plugged in, and I just did the damn deal, and I did whatever you told me to. If it was uncomfortable, bring it on. A lot of times, like, you know, speaking, it's like this fear, and I don't really get nervous anymore, but... It was, and what I started to learn was that it was very uncomfortable, but I left that podium or seat or whatever feeling 20 times better than I did when I came in there, and that always happened. And so I fed off of that anytime somebody asked me to show up to a meeting, selfishly, I might not make any sense, it might be uncomfortable, but I'm going to do it anyway because it's going to make me feel better. And I think it's okay to be a little selfish with your program, that aspect, you know. And I'm a bigger fan of talking about what it's like now. That's my favorite part. I can't count on both hands the amount of promises that have come true in my life. I cannot begin to tell you. Short list, you know, I bought a motorcycle. That was always my dream. My first year sober, got a motorcycle, got an apartment, started to meet, you know, like some of my idols, my celebrity idols that I really looked up to, and, you know, got to have these cool life experiences, and I got to be a part of life, and I got to enjoy it. And I remembered it the next day. That was cool. I don't know what time I should shut up. I'll go on for five more?
Ten?
All right, cool. So you don't mind me. Okay. I lost my job 2 days ago, and I just bought a house 3 weeks ago, so that's awesome. This last year, and especially these last 2 months, have been very challenging, and they have challenged my sobriety more than ever. I actually was in one of the probably deepest depressions I've ever been in yesterday morning in 8 years. And so I knew I had to be here. And the thing that I've learned, and I guess my favorite thing to talk about, is how do we maintain our sobriety? You know, because I've learned life happens. I've never been fired from a job since I was 16 up until 2 months ago. You know, even throughout all my drinking stuff. And so anyway, I'm from Chicago. I moved here 2 years ago, and it's been a fucking nightmare. Not that I don't love Tennessee and the people. This is great. I've had 6 jobs in 2 years, not because of, you know, not showing up, but I don't know what God's doing right now, but I can't make sense. And it's like he thinks I'm a superhero. I'm so, you know, it's like I could just take on anything right now. And so the last 2 months have been really challenging. And the truth is, you know, the last few days I've been barely holding on. But Alcoholics Anonymous told me that it doesn't matter how I feel, it's what I do. And so I show up, even if I have no clue what's going to happen tomorrow. The important thing is to show up and to stay connected and call people. My disease never goes away. It never will. I can't stay sober on yesterday's meetings. And the best thing we could do is realize that we are, no matter what, responsible to carry the message to another alcoholic that still suffers. So no matter what's going on in my life, I am still responsible to show up, and whether you get anything from this or not, which I hope you do, my job is to show up and to share my experience, because it's not about me. And hopefully that this job thing is not about me, and I hope he has a real big fucking plan, because I'm at my wit's ends of like faith, and I've got about this much left, and I'm praying that he comes through right now. Anywho, that's a thing for therapy. It's not about me, you know. And the hardest thing, the biggest thing I struggle with, is falling back into self-will. I've worked the steps multiple times. I just did my fourth step. Went through a really shitty breakup 2 months ago. My best friend died a month ago to this disease. And lost a job and bought a house and then lost another job. And it's, you know, how do you deal with all that without drinking? I don't know. I don't know how I'm here, to be honest. I don't know. But I know what I do know is that it is not better out there. It is not better out there. I know and remember what MGD tastes like. I remember what it all tastes and feels like. The trick is reminding myself that God gave me a second chance. And every breath that I take sober is a day that I'm utterly overpaid. Every sober breath that I take is a day I'm utterly overpaid. And no matter what I'm going through, I have a choice when I wake up. And I have a choice to pray, to get on my knees, to call someone, to read a meditation book, to go to a meeting, to do service, to call and see how someone else is doing. And so at this point, at 8 years sober, it's more about life. You know, I don't get cravings anymore, but it's how do I deal with life on life's terms without interjecting my fucking will, because I'm so smart and I have all the answers. You know, I have all the answers. And that's what my disease will tell me. And so a lot of times my struggle is turning my will over and understanding that sobriety gives me all these great things. And with that comes more responsibility. You get a house, you get a mortgage too. Hey, that's how it goes. And so it's just at a point now where sobriety has given me this life. And with ADHD, you can imagine it's not the easiest thing to manage, and that's something for me that I struggle with. You know, the last 2 years of my sobriety has actually been more about dealing with mental health than it has been anything else. And so that's a part of recovery too, that there's a lot of people in these rooms that also deal with mental health issues. And so it's like, how do you balance all of it? You know, how do you have time to sponsor people, pay your bills, do your laundry, take care of your dog, go to work, feed yourself, and then find time for God? And I'm kind of struggling on that last part. But I know that God has not gotten me this far just to drop me on my ass. I know that. I know that much. And yesterday when I was sharing with my friend about my not necessarily suicidal thoughts, like I don't, no one needs to worry, but my really deep thoughts about, like, I just want to give up, and, you know, she said, look, you're too awesome to die, okay? And the funny thing is that, you know, people in the rooms, we could laugh and joke about that. Funny thing is, it did make me laugh, and I was like, yeah, you're right, I am, yeah. And here I am today, and every day it's a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And that goes for everyone in this room. And so if you're not maintaining your spiritual condition, we will fall short, and we will come face to face with character defects, and we will come face to face with resentments, judgments, and selfishness. So if I keep my nose in the book and show up to meetings and put my ass in the seat, I'm likely to stay sober today. And the rest, it's up to him. If I find a job, it's up to him. If I keep my house, I guess it's up to him, me too. Got to pay the bills. But I have a responsibility to carry the message to the alcoholic that still suffers, and so that's why I'm here today. And it's not about me. So appreciate you guys having me, and that's all I got.
Thank you. What a wonderful job. Thank you so much.